Tere, and welcome to History of Estonia podcast. This is William Parsley, recording from my home office in Anderson Township, a suburb of Cincinnati, Ohio, USA. I hope you enjoyed a sample of Beethoven's Ode to Joy, the European Union anthem. We will discuss EU and NATO enlargement in this episode with Professor Andrus Kasekamp, who is Chair of Estonian Studies, Monk School of Global Affairs and Public Policy, at the University of Toronto. Prior to that, he was professor of Baltic politics at the University of Tartu in Estonia and director of the Estonian Foreign Policy Institute. His first book was The Radical Right in Interwar Estonia, which we were thrilled to discuss on this podcast. His second book, A History of the Baltic States, has been translated into 8 languages. His research interests include populist radical right parties, memory politics, European foreign and security policy, and cooperation and conflict in the Baltic Sea region. He has served as the editor of the Journal of Baltic Studies and president of the Association for the Advancement of Baltic Studies. Tere, Professor Kasekamp, and welcome back to History of Estonia podcast. It's a pleasure to have you on again.
It's a pleasure to be here, and let me thank you for the valuable work you're doing.
Oh, thank you for that. The topics we are about ready to discuss are Estonia's voyage to EU and NATO expansion. The first question that I have is, Estonia applied for EU membership in November 1995. The Clinton administration of the United States launched NATO's Partnership for Peace in the beginning of 1994, which enabled greater cooperation between NATO and Baltic countries. Was there an advantage of working towards NATO and EU membership at the same time?
Absolutely. Even though formally there was no connection between the two processes, but in fact, the success in one certainly helped with the other. Because many of the things that were required by NATO and the EU overlapped, things like the rule of law, functioning democracy, respect for human rights and the rights of ethnic minorities, all of these things overlapped. And being able to demonstrate success in one direction helped certainly with the other. And this fit very well with the whole transition era. The Baltic states and the others were just coming out of the totalitarian communist system and the command economy, and they were transitioning to democracy and the free market. And instead of having to reinvent the wheels themselves, they had this blueprint to follow, because if they had this vision or this long-term goal of joining the European Union and also NATO, then many of the reforms that they had to make for their own benefit sort of fit in very nicely with what the EU expected from them. So there was this very fortuitous overlap in terms of the timing that the Baltic societies and states had to transform themselves to become more Western anyway, and that overlapped with the timing of EU and NATO accession. We can see, for instance, if we compare it to the present, countries like Ukraine and Georgia, who missed the boat in the 90s because their societies weren't ready, there wasn't sort of consensus, and they were trying to be sort of equidistant between the West and Moscow. And they missed that window of opportunity, and trying to catch up later is just so much more difficult.
Yeah, that's a big miss. Yeah. How did the fact that Estonia was a former Soviet republic affect its road to EU and NATO membership?
Well, let me say, first of all, that the timing here of applying for NATO and EU membership in 95 had a lot to do with the Soviet legacy, because former Soviet troops were still based in Estonia and Latvia until 1994. So until they were removed, then there was really no hope of any progress towards EU or NATO membership. So that was a very necessary precondition for that. And again, that's an example of where some of the other post-Soviet states missed the boat. Countries like Moldova and Ukraine and Georgia, which continued to have ex-Soviet bases with Russian troops there, really didn't have a chance until they left. And well, as we see, Moldova, they're still there. And Ukraine is in the midst of a genocidal war. 95 is also a key watershed in that if we look at our geographical neighborhood, then the EU enlargement to the Nordic countries. In other words, Sweden and Finland joined in 95. And right. By this time, Sweden and Finland had become the largest, most important trading partners with Estonia and the other Baltic countries. So that was an important incentive. If your closest neighbors, trading partners are in this economic bloc, then you want to be there as well. Also, something that tends to happen with every round of EU enlargement is that the new member states start advocating to bring their own neighbors closer. So once Finland and Sweden were in, they started being the biggest supporters of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania coming closer to the European Union, integrating them more. Just like the Baltic states, after they joined in 2004, became the big champions of bringing in Georgia, Ukraine, Moldova, what later became known as the Eastern Partner States of the European Union.
Thank you. In 1996, U.S. Defense Secretary William Perry made it publicly clear that the Baltic states were not ready for NATO. Tomas Hendrik Ilves, the then foreign minister of Estonia, reoriented Estonian diplomatic efforts to focus entirely on EU membership. Instead of unrealistically expanding scarce resources on NATO in the run-up to the Madrid summit, Ilves' gamble paid off. To everyone's surprise, in July 1997, the European Commission named Poland, Hungary, the Czech Republic, Slovenia, and Estonia as the five post-communist countries to be invited for EU membership negotiations. How critical was it that Estonia followed Ilves' advice and went all in for EU membership?
Well, that brings us back to the previous question, which I didn't fully answer, about the impact of the Soviet legacy on the bid of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania to join the European Union and NATO. So being Soviet republics, unlike Poland, Hungary, Czech Republic, was certainly a disadvantage. Because in Western capitals, when they were envisioning expansion, be it the EU or NATO, then Poland, Hungary, Czech Republic, they were naturally considered the main contenders. And those countries which had been part of the Soviet Union in the 90s were often regarded as being sort of beyond the pale, in the sense that the former boundary of the Soviet Union was regarded as a red line, and that somehow crossing this red line would needlessly provoke Russia. So that was always in the background, less so in the EU context, but definitely in the NATO context, that bringing the Baltic states in would be unnecessarily provocative towards Russia. And that was sort of, in answering your first question, a very high hurdle that the Baltic states had to cross. And which was always kind of holding them back compared to the Central European countries. And then also, of course, compared to the Central European countries, having been part of the Soviet Union, the Baltic states simply were poorer because they were part of the Soviet Union. And they were less well known. So they had less support and sympathy in the West than the Central European countries. And of course, they had to start from scratch is unlike a Poland or Hungary, they did not have a seat in the UN. They weren't sovereign nations during the Cold War. They had to build up their own army and their own foreign service and their central bank and all these institutions from scratch, which the other post-communist countries in Central Europe had always had.
Thank you.
Now that comes now I answered your previous question, but right. The current one about Thomas Hendrik Ilves, who certainly was a visionary in that he understood that NATO membership in 1996, or the prospects of it, were in the next round were highly unlikely. And he refocused Estonia's diplomatic effort entirely on the EU, which seemed to be a more realistic goal, as it did turn out to be in 97, when the European Commission surprisingly invited the aforesaid Poland, Hungary, and Czech Republic, who are always going to be invited, plus Estonia and Slovenia, which was a great surprise. And this had a lot to do with sending this geopolitical signal that the boundary of the former Soviet Union was not a red line.
Right.
And also it helped that, like I said earlier, that Finland and Sweden were already in the European Union and they were pushing for at least one Baltic state to get in. And plus, of course, the great advantage of what Estonia had, well, I wouldn't say advantage, but what played to Estonia's strengths is that, to use the jargon of the EU and the NATO at the time, it was about the candidate countries doing their homework. In other words, doing their reforms. And Estonia had already garnered a reputation as one of the most radical and rapid reformers in the transition period in the 90s. And the EU had come up with what were known as the Copenhagen criteria in 1993 for candidate countries. And that was kind of a checklist of everything that was required. And they were labeled sort of objective technical criteria. And this made it easier for the Baltic states because, again, hooking to your previous question about how did the Soviet legacy impact on their chances for getting in? Well, politically, that was a big hindrance, but they did their homework and they could constantly claim that, look, the EU has said these are objective criteria and we are doing our homework and we're doing this better and faster than Poland is, but Poland's going to get in. So they could latch on to the fact that the EU was making it about objective criteria. So by being sort of the best pupils or best students in the class, they could compensate for the disadvantage of being former Soviet republics.
That makes sense. It was a strong argument to make. Estonia has been a staunch supporter of EU enlargement, and its politicians often stated that enlargement is its most successful EU foreign policy. Why does Estonia believe EU expansion is in Europe and its own best interest?
Well, clearly it's Estonia's own experience. Estonia has seen that in its own case and has had to sort of prove that to the doubters in Western Europe, who tend to be very often French or Spanish. And every time the argument comes up that there's some sort of trade-off between what is known as deepening or widening in the European Union. In other words, the French often sort of prioritize deepening, meaning sort of integration amongst stronger cooperation amongst the existing members, whereas some others, like Britain, while they were still in the EU, favored this widening that focused more on enlarging the bloc rather than deepening its integration. And that was often seen as sort of a choice between one or the other approach, whereas in fact that was a false dichotomy. And Estonians had to argue against that at the time and continue to do so, because every time the European Union has enlarged, it has also increased its integration. So the two actually go hand in hand. So further expansion has actually always led to greater integration as well. So there's also that argument also in the NATO context, but much more importantly in the EU context, that well, if there are so many more member states, does it become unruly? Is it sort of more? But actually, experience shows that that is not the case. That mostly it's not really the new member states which are causing much of the problems. It's still sort of the French and the Germans, and well, as we saw, the Brits leaving, and with the exception of Hungary, most of the Eastern Europeans have been on sort of their best behavior within the European Union.
Right. In 2007, because of the conflict with Russia regarding the relocation of the Bronze Soldier War Memorial, Estonia received broad support from EU countries, and because of this feeling of solidarity, Estonian popular support for the EU increased to the highest level in the EU. Estonians finally realized that the EU is not just a single market. How does EU membership provide a benefit to Estonia's national security interests? And how does EU membership affect intergovernmental relationships between Estonia and its giant neighbor to the east?
Well, exactly. In that at the time when Estonia was in the accession process, it was seen mostly as joining this economic bloc, single market to ensure Estonia's economic prosperity. And not much thought was given to the sort of political and security dimension of it. But with this Bronze Soldier crisis, when Estonia was sort of alone facing pressure from Moscow in 2007, Estonians sort of experienced solidarity from its fellow European Union member states and the European Commission. And that, to my mind, witnessing that at the time, was kind of a turning point in the understanding that Estonians had for the European Union, that no, this is not just a trading bloc, but this has much wider political and security repercussions, positive ones, for Estonia. That Estonia is not sort of left alone. Estonians, Latvians, Lithuanians subsequently, of course, have been saying that the European Union needs to speak with one voice towards Russia. And being sort of alone is not a good option for any of the Baltic states.
No, it's not. Estonia has distinguished itself as a member state which dependably adheres to the rules and is among the front runners in many fields. How has this reputation helped Estonia with both EU and NATO enlargement?
Reputation has been very important. As I was saying earlier, that the reputation for rapid reforms in the 1990s helped very much in the accession process. And then another point where this reputation became very important was during the big financial crisis, which became the European debt, the Euro debt crisis, 2009, 2010, when Estonia and Latvia showed themselves to be sort of exemplary in terms of fiscal responsibility as well. And now, with Russia's war against Ukraine, Estonia and the Baltic states are also playing kind of a leading role because they are very credible, that they have, in fact, this overlaps with the theme of NATO, but they are the ones who are actually spending on their defense, who are putting their money where their mouth is in terms of security, when other European countries have sort of been ignoring the threat. Whereas Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania are right there on the front line, and now they've been sort of vindicated, which sort of adds to their credibility and their reputation.
In an article you wrote titled "The New Member States and the EU, Estonia," you wrote, in 2005, German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder and Russian President Vladimir Putin signed the Nord Stream 1 agreement, which brought doubt among Estonians about the ability of Europe to keep its interest in mind
if a security crisis ever appeared with Russia. Consensus seems to have become a common goal in the EU. Is Germany and France now as committed to this idea of consensus as the smaller states because of Russia's war on Ukraine, or will life in Europe eventually get back to normal with Germany and France being the dominant decision makers in the Union?
Well, Germany and France will obviously be the largest and most important players in the European Union, but the whole idea and attraction of the European Union for smaller states is that it provides a level playing field, at least in theory. Without the European Union, you can imagine the French and Germans would be pushing or throwing their weight around much more, but it's the European Union which kind of keeps their more self-interested impulses in check. You can see, for instance, these sort of solos when, you know, I don't have to just talk about Russia, but you see recently French President Macron went to Beijing and talked to the Chinese and sort of seemed to be speaking in the name of the EU, but in fact he was only representing France, and there was a lot of sort of pushback from other EU member states, and particularly from the Baltic states, regarding what he was saying there, particularly with supporting the so-called peace plan that the Chinese have, which is really no plan at all, that just simply kind of supports the Russian position. But I would say that the Baltic states have become, it's taken a while, it was in steps. They joined in 2004, and it was in 2007 that they became part of the Schengen regime, sort of secured sort of free movement, and then joined the Eurozone, first Estonia in 2011, and then Latvia and Lithuania a few years later. So they have been moving from what I would term, they've been moving from the periphery of the Union to the core of the Union, that they're there where the decisions are being made and their voice is being heard. But of course, a nation of 1.3 million like Estonia will never be quite an equal to France or Germany behind the table.
Sure. NATO laid out a transparent and rigorous set of objectives called MAP. The idea of a detailed roadmap was partly copied by the EU's Copenhagen criteria for accession. How critical was MAP to Estonia's relatively quick accession into NATO?
Right. So MAP, which stands for Membership Action Plan, that was actually something that was invented because of the NATO enlargement round, which the Baltic states were part of. It was actually an additional an additional burden that Estonia and the other states that joined in 2004 had to take on. It was partly, you could say, a backlash to the fact that in 1999, when Poland, Czech Republic, Hungary joined, that they had made pledges of reform to NATO, which they were slow in fulfilling. So NATO came up with this idea that with the Membership Action Plan, that all the countries who join would actually be in fulfillment of all the requirement before they join and wouldn't be let in basically based on promises of fulfillment later. So Membership Action Plan was dreamt up for that reason. So on the one hand, it made it a bit more, say, challenging for that round. But as I alluded to earlier in the Estonian, Latvian, Lithuanian case, it actually made it simpler because it was all about doing the homework. So MAP really was a map in the sense that the Baltic countries had to, you know, check the boxes, that it was all laid out, the whole sort of program and agenda. These are the things that you need to reform and fulfill. And in this sequence and in this sort of this time period, and sort of Estonian, Latvian, Lithuanian administrators, bureaucrats, officials, politicians could point to this document and sort of follow it. And so it was much easier to make those reforms, the necessary reforms at home, because it was so much clearer. but it also made the political case easier when it came to ratification by the existing NATO member states, because the Baltic states could show that, look, here's the map, and we've checked all these boxes. We've done our homework. So, you know, you've said the doors are open, and we've done the homework, so please let us in.
In 2001, Lithuanian leaders decided on a plan to merge the southern and northern flanks of Europe and combine many of the nations previously either in the Soviet Union or the Soviet sphere of influence into an agreement to keep the region whole and free. Without Estonia or Latvia's knowledge, Lithuania approached Romania with this plan, and they immediately agreed. Bulgaria, Slovakia, Slovenia, Albania, and Macedonia also quickly joined the Vilnius group, or called the V10. Would Estonia and the other Baltic countries have made it into NATO if it weren't for the Lithuanian idea of the V10?
Well, that's, of course, all speculation. But what is clear is that having this larger group working sort of together in a united fashion, particularly in its lobbying in Washington, facilitated all of these countries joining. Because previously it had seemed kind of like a horse race, that each of these countries was kind of individually trying to show that they were on the right path, that they were the best and strongest candidates. And really, actually, the Lithuanians were, amongst the Baltic states, the ones who were most adamant about their own chances being superior to those of others. Whereas Estonia had been the leading country when it came to EU membership initially, because it had done its reforms quicker. In the case of NATO, Lithuanians had put in more effort and more money into the reforms, and thus had perhaps slightly better chance or arguments. But they kind of realized by this point with this V10 agreement that, well, kind of going it alone is not going to work in Washington, that if we can show that we have a large group, we're all on the same page, we're working together, that this increases the chances for all of us. Plus, you could also say that sort of this cooperation, first amongst the Baltic states themselves, but then amongst a larger group of Central Eastern European countries, that this was beneficial, because if they were preparing to join the alliance, this was showing a level of maturity that, look, we're able to successfully cooperate amongst ourselves, which kind of demonstrates that we're also potentially good allies when we join the alliance.
After 9/11 in New York City, the fight against terrorism was in full swing, bringing temporarily closer cooperation between Russia and the U.S. Estonian troops voluntarily contributed to the war on terrorism in Afghanistan, the war in Iraq against Saddam Hussein, and the imagined inventory of weapons of mass destruction. Did the war on terror impact Estonia's goal on NATO membership?
Well, it made the final... There were two aspects to this. In one sense, it made it a bit trickier because, as you'll recall, back in 2002, before everything was decided, the US was intent on going into Iraq, and France and Germany were very much opposed to that. And Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania had not yet been accepted into either NATO or the EU. And there was this very uncomfortable moment when they were expected kind of to decide, are you with the French and the Germans or are you with the Americans? And that was a position that Estonians never want to be in.
Right.
The Baltic states have always worked and championed transatlantic unity, that our sort of security and well-being is best safeguarded when the US and Europe work together. And when the US and Europe are split, that's a danger for the Baltic states. And so that moment before the Iraq invasion, when there was the division between the so-called old Europe and new Europe, as Donald Rumsfeld sort of classified it at the time, was very precarious for the Baltic states. But on the other hand, the global war on terror aided the Baltic states to get in because, as you mentioned, for a while, cooperation between Putin's Russia and the U.S. Increased. Mainly, I would say, because Putin was hoping to harness the global war on terror to legitimize what the terror that Russia itself was imposing on Chechnya. Right. Because they were, of course, labeling the Chechen freedom fighters as terrorists.
Yes, they
and
were.
Since they were Islamic, then that fit into that narrative very well. So there was this temporary rapprochement between the U.S. And Russia. Okay, but on the other hand, the global war on terror also provided an opening for the Baltic states, because the argument of Russia's security concerns now took sort of a back seat, because Russia was now a partner with the U.S. in the global war on terror. So this temporary rapprochement between the U.S. and Russia certainly smoothed the path. President Putin, in fact, at the time, in 2002, at the time when the NATO-Russia Council was formed, actually said that it would be no great tragedy, in his own words, if the Baltic states joined NATO. So the Russians were downplaying it at that moment as well. And from the perspective of the Baltic states, the final hurdle was ratification by the U.S. Senate, which took place in the spring of 2003, by which time the invasion of Iraq had already started. And there, the U.S. lawmakers were interested mainly in one question, that are they with us or against us in Iraq and Afghanistan? Whereas Baltic diplomats had been preparing themselves for all sorts of difficult questions on their reforms, on treatment of the Russian ethnic minority, on prosecution of suspected Nazi war criminals, all sorts of things, which didn't really get asked in the end by members of the Senate, who were mostly focused on the immediate agenda of, are they our ally in Iraq and Afghanistan? And in that, all three of the Baltic states were understandably on board. Not that any of them believed in the fiction of the weapons of mass destruction, but they knew that if this was the priority for the U.S., and the U.S. would become the main security guarantor of the Baltic states, then obviously for the Baltic states, U.S. priorities had to be their priority.
Right, right.
In that the work that Estonians, Latvians, Lithuanians did, that was also part of, that connects to what we were speaking about earlier about credibility and reputation. So Estonians, but also Latvians, Lithuanians were very eager when they were in Afghanistan in particular to work closely together with the American military. And when they did, they made sort of connections and friends and networking and established a reputation amongst American military that they are sort of reliable and you know, professional and good at what they do. Also, of course, it was from the point of view of military professionals in Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, it was very important experience in fighting alongside NATO partner countries.
Sure. Well, I appreciate you taking the time to come back on with the show. It's always a pleasure.
Likewise. Hope to speak to you again soon.
I hope so. Thank you. Nagamist.
Nagamist.
Thank you for listening. I leave you with the NATO hymn anthem of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Please follow the podcast and give it a positive review if you are so inclined. Thank you.